We've been exploring for some time now the fourth foundation of mindfulness in the sequence with everything that came before it. And the first two lists that we looked at are actually out of order in the sutta as it's preserved in modern times. We looked first at the five hindrances and then at the seven factors of awakening. I did these back-to-back partly because they're a bit of a twin set, you know, the things to avoid and the things to cultivate. But also because some of the research that's coming out now, particularly by Venerable Analio, and research looking comparatively at like the Pali Canon preserved by the Theravada school and the Agamas preserved in Chinese, that are really a parallel record of the early Buddhist system, but with some differences. Looking at those parallels and others reveals that the hindrances and the awakening factors may well be the earliest layer of the fourth foundation, and some other lists may have been tacked in somewhat later on by, you know, folks who are like, well, this list of lists seems to be spacious enough, we can gather some other lists in there. But I think that within the fourth foundation, these two are important in a very particular way, you know, coming out of the understanding of the limb of right effort to cultivate wholesome states and diminish unwholesome states. Here we have these two beautiful lists, a list of wholesome states and a list of unwholesome states. So we did those two, and now we're going back a bit. The traditional order in the Foundations of Mindfulness discourse, the Satipatthana Sutta, it's discourse number 10 in the middle-length discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya. The order in the fourth foundation there is the hindrances, and then the five aggregates, the six sense bases, and then the seven awakening factors, and then the Four Noble Truths to close it out. So we jumped to the awakening factors. Now I'm going to go back and talk about the aggregates a little bit. The aggregates and the sense bases are interesting lists to investigate of somewhat of a different order than the hindrances and the awakening factors. The hindrances and the awakening factors are qualities, right? Diminish these qualities, increase these qualities. The aggregates, I'll tend to call them aspects, but mostly they're translated as aggregates. The aggregates and the sense bases are different kinds of lists. They're really lists of ways to think about the totality of our experience. Sometimes the Buddha would say, you know, what is there, you know, monastics? There's form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. That's the five aspects or aggregates. Or he would say, you know, I'll tell you the all. What is there? There's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and you know, thinking, feeling, you know, cognizing. That's it. So there's the aspects of experience as one list that encompasses all of our business. And then there's the sense bases that are a different way of thinking about it. And so then I think of these two lists more as frameworks for inquiry rather than lists of qualities to cultivate or uncultivate. And so we'll start with the aspects or the aggregates here. And I sort of gave you one whole spiel about them in the Facebook post in the kind of lead into this talk that was mostly taken from some scholars lately. So I'll give you some of that tonight, and then we'll talk broadly about how we might think about this list. The word for these aspects or aggregates of experience is khanda in Pali, K-H-A-N-D-H-A, khanda. Some of you who may have spent time in Mahayana systems like Zen or Tibetan, this appears in some of the yoga worlds as well, might have encountered skanda as the Sanskrit parallel. So the word is the same, khanda in Pali, skanda in Sanskrit. And it literally means heap or pile or grouping. So it's kind of a technical term, a group of things. And the list of the khanda is five things, and the traditional translations, the usual translations around are form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. And we were all like, what's formations? You know, like long before Beyonce, like, what's formations? And formations refers more or less to thoughts and feelings, but not quite. And there's a really interesting translation that's happening right now by one of my favorite current translators, who I post links to a lot, Bhikkhu Sujato from Australia, who's translated the whole of the Pali Canon almost. And Bhikkhu Sujato uses choices for the fourth aggregate instead of mental formations. And that's very interesting. So we'll get to that. But the basic word is khanda, aggregate, heap, collection, aspect, type of thing. So these are five kinds of thing that we find in our experience. Form refers both to the body and to things that we see, kind of visual forms. Sometimes there's a whole compound that's like forms as seen by the eye. So there's an association with the visual as the thing that perceives forms. But the word for form is rupa, and rupa also means literally body. The word directly for body is kaya, but rupa means form in the sense that, you know, like you'll hear, like back here on the altar, you know, there's the little statue of the Buddha is a Buddha rupa. So it's a form of the Buddha, but there are discourses where the Buddha uses rupa actually to mean our physical body also. And so it has this kind of double valence. You know, there's the bodies of things you can see, like the chair, the table, other people's bodies, etc. And then there's our own body, rupa. It's physical reality, basically, if we want to really generalize. The second of the khanda, or aggregates, or aspects, is feelings. We talked about this some months back when we looked at the second foundation. This is vedana. And so if you remember vedana, this isn't really emotions in their full-blown complexity. This is really the simple feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So every sensory contact that we, every experience, every moment of experience has this tone to it of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Pleasant is sukha. You can think like sugar, sukha. Unpleasant is dukkha, painful. And neutral is technically neither pleasant nor unpleasant, na sukha, na dukkha, which rolls off the tongue nicely. So there's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's the second of the aggregates, is feeling. I sometimes, to the consternation of my Western philosophical friends, want to use the term affect for this. Affect is a psychological and philosophical term that refers to something like the basis or underlying charge in emotions. And there's a way that I think it's actually a good term, because often when we hear feelings, we don't think just pleasant, unpleasant. We think like more complex feelings like grief, joy, melancholy, you know, longing. And those have lots of layers in them, and they have lots of stories in them. And so the aggregate of feeling is in a certain way simpler than that. It's really just the bare sensory perception of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The third of the khanda is perception itself. The Pali word is sanya. And perception literally is the recognition of something such that we could give it a name. So like, I perceive your faces and my mind recognizes you as people, actually does a very complicated translation between the images on the screen and you as people and your names and our relationships and all that stuff that swims around the direct perception. Perception is that moment of recognition. You know, I see the chair, I know it's a chair. You know, I see Lisa, I know it's Lisa. I see Chauncey, I know it's Chauncey. I see the moon, I know it's the moon. I perceive, and perception has a kind of recognition quality in it. The fourth of the aggregates is sankhara, which is a very complex word, meaning a lot of things. And it partly means kind of important cognitive activity, including things like choices. And sometimes they're called volitional formations. They're like the stories and narratives and ideas about self and other and intentions and impulses, all of which give rise to the complexity of relational experience with other humans, but also with animals, the earth, spirits, beings, objects, all of existence. Sankhara really holds the complexity of our experience. And in that way, there's this beautiful weave between, you know, these second, third, and fourth, and the fifth really, which I'll say in a moment, khandhas, where, you know, there's the perception of something and there's the sense of it being pleasant or unpleasant. And then there's my feeling and volitional field in relation to it. So, you know, I see it, I like it, I want it, right? Like that's like, and then the thing I'm actually seeing is the form, right? So there's like, there's perception and there's form and there's feeling and there's sankhara, volition, impulse arising in relation to something. And so you can witness the arising of sankhara. Sankhara is what happens when there's active karma, you know, when things are happening, choices matter. Choices are the place where ethics or where our precepts are expressed, where our practice is expressed. And all of that is contained within the aggregate of sankhara. And again, for those tracking the parallels, in Sanskrit, the parallel is samskara. But it's sankhara in Pali. And the fifth of the aggregates is vijnana, which is consciousness. And this one is complex because we use the word consciousness in a lot of ways in Western culture. In the early Buddhist system, consciousness here, vijnana, is not wisdom, it's not complex, and it's not narrative, really. It's actually just the reality of conscious perception of a thing. Like, I'm conscious of seeing the screen. So it's not quite the same as perception. I perceive the screen. It's really the very bare, it's sort of like the background operating system, right? Their consciousness has to be present for there to be perception. So I'm conscious of, and in the early Buddhist system, consciousness is always consciousness of something. Consciousness is not a thing that's just floating there that you possess. You know, I have a divine consciousness. That's not the way the term is used here. This is really, you know, consciousness of a thing has arisen. Okay, that's the list. That was fairly technical and philosophical. Apologies. Now we'll get into something we'll get a little juicier with it. Khanda is a heap of things. And when the Buddha began using it, it was actually a very common word. And one of the things it meant was a heap of, for instance, firewood, a heap of sticks. And that was a common usage of it. Like, it's a bundle of sticks that you would gather from the woods to build a fire with. Fire is really important here, right? Because fire is what happens when heat connects with fuel. And so the fuel here is sensory objects, you know, other people that we want something from or that we're in relationship to, the world that we want things, you know, in relation to, things we like, things we dislike. The sensory world is the fuel, and the heat, in a way, is the impulse, the ancient impulses toward greed, hatred, and delusion. The heat here is grasping. And what happens when the heat of grasping or wanting really the heat of dissatisfaction. Like, I'm not happy. What can I come into contact with in this world that will help me be happy? Grasping looks for an object. And when it hooks onto something, you know, that object, that food, that person, that experience, it makes a connection. Grasping happens, and grasping is followed by clinging, the active impulse of trying to be in relationship with that thing, in proximity with that thing, trying to make certain contact last longer or painful contacts to go away. There's an engagement that is habitual and you know, addictive in its tone. So the khanda are actually the thing that burns. And the word khanda, the aggregates, is often in a compound that is the aggregates affected by clinging. So these are five things we cling to. And the word clinging is upadana, which literally means feeding. So five things that fire feeds on. And there's a whole analysis of this that talks about how the Buddha is actually making this complex pun on fire and fuel, because in the old Vedic system, before the time of the Buddha and contemporary with him, householders and Brahmanic priests were required to keep three sacrificial fires burning in the household all the time, at certain directions for certain purposes with certain mantras and rituals. And the Buddha would say, you know, we're in this practice to extinguish three fires, the fire of greed. And there's the famous fire sermon, monks, the world is burning. Everything is burning. What is burning? The eye is burning. The ear is burning. The nose, tongue, body, and mind are burning. Burning with what? Burning with the three fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the khanda are a bundle of things, five bundles of things that burn. So we become attached to or identified with, or we cling to form. How do we cling to form? How do I cling to my body? Being a certain way, looking a certain way, feeling a certain way, being mine, being young, being alive, being healthy. All of this is clinging to form, right? We cling to others' forms, of course, other people's bodies, but also, you know, the bodies of certain objects. I cling to my house. I'm quite attached now. Having arrived here, I like it very much. Clinging has arisen, you know, to form. We cling to all of these different aspects of the physical world, the material world, being a certain way. This is clinging to form. We cling to feeling, of course, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Of course, we want more of the pleasant, less of the unpleasant. You know, if we've had a lot of the unpleasant, we might crave the neutral. If we've had too much neutral, we might crave either pleasant or unpleasant. All of these can be thought of as ways that the psychology squirms in relation to reality. We crave feelings. We crave perception. We get attached to perception. I want to perceive certain things. You know, I want certain experiences to come into my field. I want to be recognized and to recognize other things in certain ways. We cling deeply to choices, to sankhara, to the mental formations of, you know, the stories that guide our actions, the actions that have results, the way that we're in relationship, intimate relationship with the whole, everything around us. All of this affected by clinging. And of course, we cling to consciousness itself. You know, if you see, you know, someone in the process of dying, or sometimes in the process of going under, you know, anesthesia or coming out of anesthesia, you can see viscerally the process of clinging to consciousness. Sometimes there's a kind of trauma where falling asleep becomes frightening. This can happen in little children sometimes. This can happen with insomnia, a strange kind of clinging to consciousness. But, you know, in the bare form of consciousness, being just conscious of that, you know, I cling to just this, like, it's almost like clinging to existence, clinging to consciousness. And so these fires burn in all of these ways. And in a way, you know, each of these lists that's like a list of all that exists, you know, the list of the six sense doors is similar to this. You know, the list isn't absolute or divine in some way. It's like there's other ways you could divide up experience. But this list is elegant in a certain way. It's one of the more technical lists. It's what we would call phenomenological. Like it's fairly philosophical, you know. The bare bones of you know, body, emotion, perception, you know, cognition and consciousness. It's not really about stories. It's not really about, it's not about the hindrances or the, you know, high level qualities. It's much more basic than that. And in this way, it's actually relatively difficult to be mindful of in a clean way. You know, it's hard to be mindful of just the bare act of perception of something. That's difficult because there's so many stories that get in the way first. It's much easier in a way to be mindful of the hindrances, you know, or of other aspects of my experience. I think the easiest thing to be mindful of here in some ways is Vedana, you know, the pleasantness, the unpleasantness. And I think that's partly why it's all the way back in the second foundation. It's much more, you know, foundational, or, you know, to and important to get good at. But the khanda are here in the fourth foundation because you can notice them. We notice them when they become the objects of clinging. And so our reflection on them can be something. This is one of the lists that's like, not just is there grasping or is there clinging, but to what actually am I clinging? What actually am I grasping onto? This is a way of saying, I notice that I'm suffering. What's up? You know, what's going on? What's actually happening here? Because sometimes the reflection on, let's say, Vedana, you know, if I'm suffering, I could always say, well, you know, something's happening and that I don't want. Something's happening in a way I don't want it. That's probably true. Mindfulness of the aggregates, of the khanda, can be a way of fleshing that out, of getting more more depth for that. So what actually is it that's happening that's uncomfortable? You know, what really is it? You know, is it something about material reality? You know, is there something in my body or the physical space that I'm grumpy about or that I'm suffering about right now? You know. And maybe it is. Maybe it's like I'm injured in a certain way. I have pain. You know, there's a certain kind of ongoing discomfort around something. Say, oh, I'm clinging to form. I'm clinging to rupa, to this first khanda. Maybe I can notice that actually it's not so much the physical situation, but there's just unpleasantness. You know, maybe there's anxiety. You know, and it's unpleasant. I say, oh, this is just unpleasant, you know. I think the third and fifth, perception and consciousness are they're pretty subtle, so they're hard to directly notice, like, oh, I'm clinging to perception. One of the ways that I'll notice that I'm clinging to perception is like, I'll see, like, for instance, I'll see an image, And I'll that's attractive, for instance. And I'll notice that for a moment, like the natural period where I needed to like be interested in it or understand what was going on or something has passed. And now there's just a sustaining feeling of like wanting to keep looking at it. There was a kind of fascinating, there was a sexy image that somebody posted, one of my friends on Facebook today. not explicit, totally, or just a person, but, you know, in a sexy place. And I scrolled by it. I saw the image. It was a little startling. You know, it was a little bit sexier than usually happens on Facebook. And I could notice that, like, I perceived who it was and what they were doing and what was happening. And then in a way, I was over it already. Like, there was no more story to tell about it. But then I could notice that there was this impulse to pause scrolling. And it's like, oh, there's just the desire to keep looking. And I was like, oh, that's clinging to perception in some certain way. Like, I could notice it's pleasant. There's not story. There's not a lot of sankhara about it. There's not a lot of other things. You know, we could say there was the hindrance of grasping at sense pleasure. It's a very minor sense pleasure, you know. But there you go. But I could notice that little bit of clinging, you know, the desire for the perception of that thing to continue. And I noted that. I was like, oh, look, you know, desire to stay. And I was like, I don't need to do that. I could tell, like, not only do I not need to do that, but actually if I persist in doing this for much longer, it'll become unwholesome. So I was like, thank you very much. You're beautiful. Onward, you know, and maybe well. And as soon as I scrolled past it, it disappeared from my mind. Like, it didn't come back until just now when I was trying to think of an example of exactly this. Grasping at perception, like oh, there's a way that perceiving something can just stick in the mind. And for a moment, it kind of hooks in. You know, the news actually is like this a lot for me. You know, I've read all the headlines I need to. There's a desire to keep perceiving it. And I'll stay in the news much longer than I need to. Grasping at sankhara, grasping at choices, this one cuts really deep, psychologically speaking. Because if we think of sankhara as, here's some of the translations, like, you know, volitional formations, this is really like how I make choices in relationship to the world. They usually have a kind of ethical or sort of some charge to them, right? This is really where I express all the stuff that is myself. This is where the stronger emotions find their purchase, find their expression, find their words. This is where all the decisions that shape my life happen. So of course we cling to those things, you know. Clinging to choices sometimes feels as simple as, and this is important when there's wounding and trauma, clinging to the fact of having choices at all. So we know with trauma that one of the things that trauma is never consensual, right? Like, no one ever chooses to be hurt. And so healing trauma always requires some return of agency. A person needs to be able to choose their own experience, to say yes or no to things that are happening to them, to consent to what's happening to them. And so there's a way that clinging to aspects of choice in that context is helpful, is wholesome, right, in the context of healing. But if you want to go toward the deconstruction of all clinging, eventually we have to get to those aspects as well. You know, the way that, oh, clinging to agency or choice is clinging to something that is fundamentally illusory. Like, we choose our actions somewhat. They're deeply conditioned by the past. So choice is a little mysterious. But eventually we have to let it go. And there's phases in practice. This is a really interesting one, clinging to choice, you know, to agency, volition, choices. There's some phases in practice where it's really important to make a lot of active, wholesome choices, to really choose where you put yourself, exactly what you're doing, you know, to really have both hands on the wheel at 10 and 2 and look at the map and choose where you're going and, you know. And there's other times in practice, and it's not linear, sorry, hasn't been for me anyway, where it's really necessary to lay back and be like, you know, it's your will, Lord, not mine. And to see where the path takes you, to surrender agency and choice. And of course, it's important to do that in ways that are well contained and well structured. You know, don't surrender your agency or choice to a, you know, to an unethical teacher or system or organization or relationship. But in a context where you can do so safely and with support, it's an incredible meditation, you could say, to let go that fully. And of course, they weave into each other. Sometimes you're hell-bent on practicing control, and you realize that you're powerless to control things. That's an important insight. Other times you're practicing deeply letting go, and you realize that even the act of trying to practice deeply letting go and, you know, is itself a form of trying to control your experience. And you're like, shit, I can't not do it. It's like saying, it's like saying, don't be aware. It's like, well, you can't. Once on retreat at Spirit Rock, I had this moment of I stumbled into really trying to figure this out. I was really trying to notice intention and action moment to moment, which is part of the Mahasi system of noting. You know, I would note discomfort, wondering whether I should get up, deciding to get up, intending to move, beginning to move. And I was trying to moment discern intention and its results again and again. And I had this practice of skipping breakfast in order to do yoga. So I would do the morning sitting, and then instead of going to breakfast, I would do yoga, which was really nice because all the people were down at the dining hall and I was an aversive type. I didn't like eating breakfast with all the people. So I would have solitude in the lower hall and do my yoga practice. There was a few of us that did it, me and my friend Ronnie and another person. We had the sort of secret Ashtanga club in the basement. And every morning after the morning sit at 7 a.m., we would be down there huffing and puffing, doing our jump backs. But I came out of the hall one morning, 7 o'clock, everyone's heading down to breakfast. And I had this thing where generally I skipped breakfast and went to do yoga. But sometimes if I was really hungry or it just felt more wholesome to go and eat, I would go down and eat. And, I was also practicing not being super, disciplined, like forcing myself. So I was really trying to feel what the right path was moment to moment. And on this particular day, I walked out of the main hall, beautiful morning, mist is coming down. And it was literally like two paths, walk that way and there's oatmeal, walk that way and there's the yoga mat. And I just stopped at the fork and I couldn't move. And I turned my attention to what was happening, and I noticed that it was just like there would be an impulse to go the one way, and then it would just like dissolve, and then an impulse to go the other way, and it would dissolve. And I could feel actually that the two impulses had different amounts of strength, and I could feel how those impulses were themselves conditioned. I could feel in the impulse to go down to breakfast a certain laziness, like, I don't want to go do yoga today. I'm just going to go have some oatmeal, And then I could feel a different impulse being like, don't be lazy, be more austere, do the thing. And I'd be like, I'm not practicing that kind of discipline right now. It's okay to do that. I feel guilty for doing that. The mind was doing its thing. And it was just like, and I realized at a certain point that whichever one of those impulses had the most kind of karmic weight or momentum, basically like whichever one won the argument, even if I, whatever that means in big scare quotes, even if I stepped in and said, listen, you guys, I'm deciding this for you, we're doing this, all that would be was one of them having stronger conditions in that moment. And I would do that. And I was like, there's nobody deciding. There's just these competing impulses arising in an ecosystem of self. And one of them's going to win out. And whichever one I think I'm choosing, all that means is that one had more momentum on this given day, had more conditions behind it. And those conditions are not self. And the whole thing just dissolved in a like, oh. And that afternoon, I went to my teacher and I was talking about this. And I said, it's clearly important to try really hard in practice and to make good decisions in life. But it's also totally clear that there's that it's kind of out of my hands. Like, I'm not really doing it. And he said, don't tell anybody. It's true, but you have to pretend like you have choices. And you could take that with a grain of salt too, right? He was talking to that particular conditioned reality that was talking to him at the moment. It's also true that we have choices. The thing that he was pointing to is that there's something really mysterious in practice, in cultivation, really just in life, that every part of ourself is conditioned, including the part that makes choices, or, you know, the aspect. This is why it's so beautiful to have the list of the khanda, because they're impermanent, they're impersonal, right? Choices arise. Choices arise in the field. Where do they arise from? You know, they arise based in conditions. You've got to do something. You've got to either eat breakfast or do yoga or do something else, you know. You make more options, you get even more confused, you know. One of the Waldorf suggestions for parenting that I value quite a bit is don't give them too many choices. And don't make the choices too complicated. It's really like, do you want to wear the blue shirt or the pink shirt? You know, I didn't mean to make those the two classic gendered ones. It could be anything. You know, do you want to wear the green or the purple? You know, but not like choose a shirt among your 30, you know, wildly different shirts, which is a recipe for emotional disorganization, you know. So rather than saying, you know, what do you want to do right now? You say, you know, do you want to play checkers or jump on the trampoline? This is really useful for adults as well. Internally, it's useful for me in the realm of ADD, for instance, which I probably have. I more and more think so. You know, so I'll say to myself, not like which of the 40 tasks that are, you know, screaming for attention or seem to be, do you want to do? It's more like, you know, of the important tasks, I'm going to suggest to you that you either send this email or work on this project. And that's the only choices I'm giving you. All of that's important. Choices are important. And it's important, you know, it's not just what the teacher said, you know, pretend as if you have choice. That was him talking to me of that age. I was 25 or whatever. You really do have choice. There's not really a you making the choices, but it's very important that choices happen. And what you choose, this is the important part, what you choose really matters. And so it actually mattered in the flow of my retreat, whether I chose oatmeal or yogurt, I mean yoga. It didn't matter a lot, but you know, it mattered such that everything that happened after that was conditioned in part, in, you know, microscopic part, by that thing having happened. And that's true for all of our choices. So our choices determine the future, contribute to the future. Every last little choice does. And so mindfulness of choices as a thing that can be clung to becomes this practice of learning to witness the complexity of the cognitive process, really, and how that process solidifies into a sense of self, solidifies into, you know, preferences and needs and demands and complaints and whining about the world and you know, or solidifies into heroic action or, you know, any number of things. Or how choice can actually arise free from any of that constriction, free from the constriction of self, free from the constriction of personality, and but not free from importance. Right? That it's possible to make wise choices that have real impact and who are important without being the one who makes important choices. It's possible to let go, to not cling to sankhara, And not clinging to it doesn't impede its function at all. It actually liberates its function to more clearly do what is wholesome. One of the ways that practice really takes off is when, I might say you, or I might say we, but I'll say I, just since I told the story about myself and the choice point. Practice really takes off when I figure out how to get out of the way of that choice moment with my personality, essentially how to suppress the hindrances from taking over that choice moment, and instead allow the awakening factors, or you might say, or the precepts, or my vows, or refuge, or something wholesome like the sense of urgency in practice to make the choice. Sometimes I make the choice to have a cold shower instead of a hot one. I actually vastly prefer hot ones. And I am not of the sort of body that, you know, really craves the cold. I'm not a Wim Hof practitioner by any means. I'm the opposite. I like being warm in a million ways. Comfortable. But sometimes I can sense that it would be helpful for my emotional state, my energetic state, to do cold. It's very difficult for me to force myself to do so. But I can do a thing where I actually relax my sense of what I want. And I let this thing arise that is something like the inner guide for practice. And that inner guide actually is much more equanimous, and it has a clearer sense of what's good for me. Right? I do this also when I find that I might, you know, eat too much sugar. Is I become mindful of the urge for comfort or entertainment or sweetness or whatever. And I let that, I'm mindful of that thing. I'm like, well, that's grasping at form, grasping at perception, grasping. And just noticing that and relaxing that allows this other force to make the choice. I really let go of clinging to sankhara and let sankhara arise by itself. And then there's an inwardly arising impulse toward wholesomeness. And from that inwardly arising impulse toward wholesomeness, it's actually much easier to resist the urge to do something unwholesome, like eat too much sugar, or accept the impulse to do something that's uncomfortable, but actually beneficial, like taking the cold shower. And so this fourth one particularly, I think really the first and the fourth, clinging to form, clinging to feeling, clinging to formations or choices, I think is really where a lot of purification work can happen. As we notice where we get stuck, these are places where we can, the instruction to be mindful of clinging here can arise, say, oh, this is that thing. I'm becoming attached to a certain choice. I've clung to the nature of volition. What if I soften here? I become mindful of that clinging, right? This is still just part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Become aware of that clinging. And then become aware of the quality of choice or of any of the khanda just by themselves, arising as a natural conditioned phenomenon. You know, even that fifth, consciousness, I'm like, I'm just aware that I'm conscious. You know, and this is going to come into mindfulness at the moment of death for all of us someday. What will it be like to be mindful of being conscious and to know that we will at some point soon be unconscious in whatever way that means, without getting into bardos and future births, but like death will come. Unconsciousness will come. And, to let go of clinging in relation to consciousness itself is to unbind such a deep aspect of who we are that liberation is very nearby, very close, when we can find that. All right, so we'll pause there. And make some space for reflections here. what's interesting to you here, what's challenging, or clarification on the list since we're doing a new list right now. Anna's comment in the chat, I'll read. This is also so impacted by white Western capitalistic sense that we know what is right and we should get what we want. I definitely agree. Like, there's a way that even more, the white Western capitalistic thing for sure, even more broadly than that, throughout the entirety of Western philosophy and religion and kind of metaphysics, is in a really different way than in the Buddhist world, the centrality of the individual sense of self. This is me, my choices, my liberty, my freedom, my relationships, my, you know, creativity. Some of the beauty that led to, you know, the flowering of creativity in, you know, the Renaissance and beyond, was interwoven with the sense of the extraordinary, almost divinity of the autonomous self. You know, and this is fundamentally Christian, right? And in a sense, this is fundamentally Protestant, that every individual has a direct one-on-one relationship with God, and that's just absent from the Buddhist worldview. And so then everything that follows that, philosophically, sociologically, politically, is different. In a way, I'm not surprised that Buddhist cultures, you know, when they did come up with like a social philosophy, largely came up with broadly socialistic ideas more quickly than they came up with, you know, more individualistic ideas. Individualistic ideas were adopted wholeheartedly by some Buddhist cultures like Thailand and Japan. But the systems that the Buddha proposed in the form of the monastic Sangha and other systems, and systems, you know, developed in the modern period by people like Buddhadasa and Ambedkar in India, had a much more communal ethos. And I think I might trace this partly to the relative de-emphasis of the individual in the Buddhist, thought, within Buddhist thought. And so then that kind of metastasizes in, you know, modern, kind of the modern late industrial period, where the individual is so highly uplifted. And I think that does make this kind of practice more challenging for folks, you know, like myself and many of us, I think, who grew up in and were steeped in, you know, the individualism, whether right or left wing. Like, I grew up with, you know, Free to Be You and Me, which was glorious childhood, you know, support for being a creative, autonomous, you know, bright individual. I was told by my parents that, you know, I could do anything, I could be anything I wanted to be. That has, you know, white Western capitalistic privilege in it. It's also a lovely message for a child, you know, to be creative. And so I took them at their word and I became a musician and an experimental performer and a yogi and a Dharma geek. And it took me several decades to realize that being anything I wanted to be was not necessarily synonymous with making a living. So there was some suffering that eventually came down the pike with that one. But I think it was fundamentally, you know, generous. But it has a shadow, you know, like everything. Other thoughts about getting what you want, you know. About any of this. I was surprised that it really went toward choices, but not also. Like, that's the one where there's so much juiciness. Sankara.
And what you were saying about, being sort of in yoga and opium, and you know, these sort of two impulses is the way you were describing them, that had conditions, and whichever one had the stronger conditions was going to kind of win the battle. I find really interesting, and also it maps a lot to parts work, you know, the internal family systems model, but in that frame, it's considered, my computer is telling me it might die in a moment, so this might be it for me, but
stay.
I have to go plug in a moment, but just that, you know, those are fragments of your personality that get broken off by trauma, actually, or by traumatic experiences, and then they wind up becoming these parts in psyche.
Yeah.
I mean, it's similar, it's just kind of philosophically, maybe a little bit different, but I think it's similar.
I think it brings in a really important aspect of this, you know, the way that, like, that a different way of telling that same story would be that, like, I got confused, you know, my impulses got confused, my signals got crossed, and I happened to be doing this, like, intensive mindfulness thing, which can deconstruct your patterns, and so it's, that actually happens a lot, that you get confused, because your habits get broken apart. But it was very much parts of myself, you know, like the disciplined one who resists the norm, and then the other one. And the reflection that you're bringing in, you know, Karen, from that work that I think is really insightful is that, you know, that breaking apart is a symptom of trauma, you know, is a symptom of disruption in the system. And I would say broadly that the Dhamma, you know, both, you know, recognizes that to the extent that they recognize that this clinging, like the confusion that would happen. Why wouldn't I just have an innate, you know, selfless sense of the wholesome and just follow that moment to moment without any dissonance or confusion? Like that would be an unwounded system in a certain way. I would just know what's the right next thing to do. A wounded system gets confused about what to do. Buddhas don't get confused about what to do. And so There's this way that you know, the, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are like these deep trauma symptoms, and all of their subtle manifestations are you know, variations of the same. All the trauma symptoms are variations of the same. I'm trying to keep myself safe somehow, you know. So I do all of these internal and external maneuvers to manipulate things so that I feel like I'm not being threatened. And so the restoration of this, like the Buddha gives this very interesting, essentially, recipe for healing that split, which is that stopping clinging, takes the confusion out of the moment, and offers helpfully that oatmeal and yoga are both wholesome. Indeed, this is one of the benefits of, you know, being on retreat and having generally good habits. I was choosing between two. You can't go wrong. Oatmeal and yoga, you know, really very good. Which points to actually the fact of it as a trauma symptom. Like there's no problem here. I could do either. And and if I was practicing in a more non-dual system, I would have a different pathway for really just zooming out and just following impulse and trusting it. But what I ended up doing was actually getting to see the part of myself that had constructed a whole story around, if I only do one meal a day, and if I, you know, do the most, if I do retreat in the most austere way, you know, that somehow, essentially, like, I'll be okay, right? It'll be better. There's nothing wrong with going to breakfast. And I had constructed a story that I was tougher and stronger and moving along faster or whatever. You know, I was going to have better experiences if I went and did the yoga. And that was exactly the reason why I got confused. Because that story is not right. It's partial, you know. Karen has dissolved into not being connected to us, but is out there. Blessings. Maybe she'll make it back with some plug-in power. There you are. It really points, Karen, to the thing that you're saying about, like, the splitting off is a trauma symptom. The fact that I could get so confused about two things that are essentially wholesome, you know, is exactly about how clinging works and how deluded ideas about the self, you know, play out to try to, you know, basically all of that could, we could simplify that down to, you know, I don't feel very good about myself. So given these two choices, which of them is going to make me feel better about myself? And I had been on a, I had been cruising for a couple of weeks on being sure that I knew which one of those made me feel better about myself. And I went far enough with that, that I cracked and I was just stuck on the path. And I stood there for half an hour, you know, because I was committed to just like not forcing it. I was just like, I'm really going to just watch this play out. So in trauma language, we would say I froze, right? I got overwhelmed by the amount of complexity in the system. I froze and I just waited until it played out. And then I went to breakfast.
It sounds like you froze, but you also had mindfulness, that you also had some cortical function. Like, it doesn't sound like it was totally freezing because you were tracking the freeze.
That's the beauty of retreat, right? Like, freeze doesn't necessarily mean that you're not tracking. I think for a lot of us in ordinary life, it does. Retreat is magical in this way, that I could actually be in a state like that. I literally, like, I could have just, like, stopped the process and chosen and gone. I was interested in seeing it, but I could also feel the way that as long as I was committed to, you know, you're right. I don't actually know what, how exactly I would call it freeze. It was like, I was committed to not acting until I really knew why I was acting. I think that's it, you know? And so that stopped me in my tracks, literally, you know, but I wasn't actually emotionally overwhelmed. It was more like I was just deep in Vipassana, really. And that just happens. People just stop, you know, and I was just noting and watching and yeah. So no, it's true. It's true. I don't want to say too. I don't want to be too facile about that process. It's actually a pretty rarefied way to do that investigation a few weeks into long retreat, because the mind actually has the conditions to see it that clearly. Most days, that whole thing happens in a blink, and I'm just like reacting. You know, and that's harder, of course. David, yeah.
Kind of just want to build on that, but also plug back in to what you were saying about choices and the cold shower example that you gave. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of just wanting some more clarification around like choices, because from that example and that metaphor, in a way, I'm hearing like this intentional act of choosing. It almost feels like a verb versus like a noun.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering whether that's the purification that you're speaking to.
Yeah.
In the process of kind of like deconditioning from I don't know if that makes sense, but I mean, I've heard a little bit of that in the oatmeal and yoga example.
I gave the different example because it had a different flavor. This kind of example happens a lot in practice, you know, like, you know, I have a slight soreness in my hips. Do I stay with it and relax around it and become, you know, be mindful of discomfort as a sensation? That can be totally wholesome. Or do I move and, you know, restore physical comfort? That can also be totally wholesome and supportive of agency. And, you know, they're both good choices at different moments in practice. Purification is such an interesting word. Visuddhi, becoming clear, pure, clean. sometimes we use it casually to mean like, oh, I sit through the pain, that's purification. I don't think that's the best, that's not the best way I want to use that word. But what I do want to use it as is something like when habitual sankhara, when habitual momentum is happening, choices are happening that are strongly tied to past conditions, often unwholesome ones. You know, like craving is making the choice for me. You know, why am I going for this chocolate? Why am I looking at this image? Why am I reading this thing too much? Why am I saying these words? Like at any moment, here's the thing about choice. At any moment, choices are being made. They are either conscious or unconscious. Unconscious choices are going to be habitual. They're going to tend to be, you could say, like based in addictions, like to comfort or to, you know, any number of things that are preferable, seemingly preferable. One of the main things we do in practice is we wrestle away conscious choice, away from our addictions, away from our habits. And we say, no, in relation to like, here's a moment, I'm going to get in the shower, I could take it cold or I could take it hot. I have a craving for hot, but I also have some experience and teaching from various elders, from traditions, but also direct experience from having done it, that doing cold has different effects. And sometimes it's really good for my energy, for my mind, and it's also, for me, sometimes really good practice in relation to craving comfort. You know, it's good for me to do it, and it takes about 3 seconds to realize that I can tolerate it. I'm not going to die, you know? And that seems helpful. And so then there's this, like, the purification is in a way strengthening discernment and intuition to say, what's the most wholesome choice in this moment? And maybe more than wholesome even, they're both relatively wholesome. What's the most skillful choice given my goal? And maybe this is a different way to say it. I want to be liberated. I want to awaken. I'm not practicing just randomly. Like there's a purpose to the path, which is to be free of suffering. I want to be free of suffering. I want to practice well in a way that succeeds at leading to the result of being free from suffering. So what to do in relation to that? And so I want to feel into, like, okay, in this moment, if I could let my preferences or my traumas be known but not drive the bus, what would the skillful, like, most leading onward to liberation choice be? And sometimes I can do that. Sometimes I can actually take my hands off the wheel and be like, you know, O path, O Dhamma, what's the thing? You know, if I don't struggle, then something's actually going to arise that's going to be like this. And I trust my precepts that you know, it's not going to be an unwholesome choice. Part of why we study the path, I think, is we're trying to imprint upon the psyche the possibility of making choices that go against my habits, but that are onward leading toward liberation. Say, oh, I could do this because, you know, because I have a sense that it works, because the great monks do it, you know, all the reasons from the Kalama Sutta. That you might do something. You do it because you know it works. So I choose cold sometimes because I know it works, even though I don't like it. Last moments. Anyone want to just drop a final sentence of blessing into the field as we close? A reflection from a different angle or place. All right. And there's always space to join in and continue in the conversation. We'll continue. We'll continue with the khanda. There's some different angles we'll bring in. As always, gratitude for your presence, your warmth, your participation, your honesty, intimacy with the group, and once again, blessings for all those in the path of fire and regime change and all of the uncertainties of this world. May everyone be safe. May we each be safe. May our deep patterns be unbound. May we all be free. May all beings be free. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting this group and this work with your generosity. I feel it warmly received, and I send my gratitude back to you. I'll see you again soon.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.